Okay, good morning. Welcome to our, what is probably the second live CLE to take place in Minnesota since about March. My name is Richard Clem. We're coming to you today live from Eden Prairie, Minnesota on August 15th, 2020, where we are doing a live drive-in CLE program. We have a couple of attorneys here listening on their car radios. Oh, and I do appreciate you taking a picture of me. I was actually going to ask that. I would appreciate, I see Gary, you're taking a picture. If you could email me one of those, I'd appreciate that, just for future reference. In the Chevy, Gary, in the Honda, we have Steve. We had a small but enthusiastic crowd this morning. Because I did not advertise this program too much. I wanted to kind of do it as an experiment to work out any possible bugs that there might be. So I sent out an email to a small subset of my mailing list to see how many people we could get to come, and two is a pretty good number. So I welcome both of you, and I am recording the program for the benefit of a future podcast program. So for that reason, I'm going to be giving a couple of code numbers during the course of the program. Those of you who are here live do not have to write those down, but if you're listening to the recording, that's how we take attendance. And when I first decided to start putting this program together, my initial reaction was, well, a very timely topic is the various court orders that the Minnesota Supreme Court has issued, and the federal courts and pretty much every court for dealing with the COVID-19 emergency. So my initial reaction was, maybe just do a program summarizing where the courts are right now with the current emergency. But then the more I thought about that, that's just a constantly changing situation. So by the time I wrote the program, a new order would have come out, and the program would not be particularly timely. I do have a link in the course materials the page on the Minnesota Supreme Court website where they talk about those orders. Just in general, the courts are functioning. I guess I wouldn't say normally, but they're functioning remarkably well. There have actually been in Minnesota a couple of jury trials, not very many, because that is obviously a very difficult situation to have to deal with, because at this point, if I received a jury summons in the mail, I think I would normally go do my civic duty and eagerly serve on jury duty. Right now, I think if I got that, though, I would opt out of it. In Minnesota, if you get a jury summons, you have pretty much one opportunity to delay the time of your jury service without giving any reason whatsoever. That's always been the rule. So if you just call the clerk's office and say, I don't want to serve jury duty right now, put me in later, they'll move you out a few months. So that accommodation is available for persons who want to delay their service, and they are very, very liberally granting exemptions to people who don't want to serve on jury duty. Now, that seems to be, it would be a little bit problematic for me. If I were a criminal defendant right now, I would be a little bit reluctant to have a jury composed of persons who are enthusiastic about the prospect of serving on jury duty at this time, because I think the whole thing has gotten so politicized that the fact that a person is willing to transact business in a government building maybe implies that they have a certain political leaning that's probably not too beneficial if you're a criminal defendant. Or maybe it is more beneficial. But like I say, it seems to me it's the courts are going to have a hard time picking a a cross-section of the community to serve as juries at this time. But other than that, the courts seem to be functioning pretty much as usual. I've only had a couple of cases involving probate matters where even if there is an in-person court hearing, usually that's just kind of a formality anyway, and they're not doing those. Everything can pretty much be done through e-filing. So so the courts are functioning. And like I say, if you want to see the particular particular orders, they are linked in the course materials. The other topic I just want to address before we get too far is because, like I say, today I think is about the second live CLE that's probably been conducted in the state. Because personally, I'm, even though it's probably legal at this point, I'm personally not comfortable going into a conference room or meeting room with a bunch of unknown people breathing the same air. And for that reason, I think for a lot of activities that would normally be conducted indoors, I think an outdoor setting really is a viable alternative. I saw in the news yesterday that the United States District Court had a naturalization ceremony. To a large extent, naturalization ceremony is more of a ceremonial function, celebration for the people who are getting their citizenship. But it's very much required by law. They have to report in person and personally be sworn in by the judge. The U.S. District Court did that ceremony yesterday outdoors. Because even though many indoor activities are simply not possible at this point, conducting them outdoors is a viable alternative. And I think schools should keep that in mind. The school district where my daughter goes, Roseville, they're grappling with these issues. The current plan is to have hybrid learning. They will attend school 2 days a week. I don't know if that's going to happen. I kind of have my doubts. I think things might change between now and then. There is an option for distance learning that anybody can take. I think that's probably what we're going to wind up doing. But many of those activities, certainly not everything, and you certainly can't have your algebra class outdoors in January, probably in Minnesota. But many of those things where in-person contact is necessary, I think outdoor activities are viable. So a couple of weeks ago, I did a CLE in Roseville in a city park. Where we had a bigger crowd that time. We had three attorneys attending instead of just two. But we just brought our own lawn chairs from home, and the program worked just as well as it would in a hotel conference room or something like that. So I think we should be mindful of those opportunities to safely transact various kinds of business outdoors. And that's why I wanted to kind of do this experiment, to give an indication that, yeah, you can do outdoor learning activities. A kindergarten class is going to actually look a lot different than a group of attorneys. But we do need to think outside the box at this point. Literally think outside the building the use of outdoor spaces. A small group gathering in a park or in the yard of an office building or in a parking lot is a good choice. You've probably noticed that many churches, for example, are doing their services outdoors. And as you noticed in the course materials, I had some discussion of that. Why are we using this old-fashioned AM radio rather than FM? Well, the thing to watch out for is there are rules about unlicensed radio transmitters. And most you can go to Amazon or eBay and buy a transmitter that that can be heard for miles. And most of them, well, are not legal. And the ones that are legal, well, can't be heard for miles. They can be heard for a matter of feet. So the reason I have this AM transmitter is because the rules for on the AM broadcast band are actually a lot more lenient than for FM. So in fact, when I was testing this at home, and it is certified by the FCC transmitter, well, there are places I can hear it like a mile away. So it actually does get out. So anyway, if you are planning on using radio in a parking lot kind of thing, the main thing is to keep in mind that there are rules governing that. I have them linked actually in the course description. So if you want to take a look at those. But as far as the actual topic of today's program, as I sometimes do, is just have a summary of some recent court decisions. And because we're in Minnesota, I'm going to be looking mostly at the Minnesota Supreme Court and some other courts around the region. Just some recent developments in what's going on in the law in our region. The Minnesota Supreme Court is churning out opinions. They're having their conferences by Zoom, and their work is continuing more or less without interruption. Well, with the exception of the last week or so, and I think they normally take August off, so there haven't been any there weren't any cases this past week, but there have been quite a few opinions. As always, unfortunately, the main amount of work that the Minnesota Supreme Court and any state Supreme Court does is attorney discipline cases. There are a couple of those that were handed down recently. One I did not summarize too much, but I have a link actually directly to the court's opinion, is the Quinn case, which was decided about 2 weeks ago. I didn't write down the date here. But the In re Quinn case, and it looks kind of unremarkable, 18-month suspension for misappropriation of client funds. Well, if you steal money from a client, you kind of understand that you're probably going to get in trouble. So that's not too surprising that you're going to get suspended 18 months for stealing money from a client. But this case, kind of the lesson here is that you have to be really careful, because this was not, as far as I can tell from reading the opinion, of a case of an attorney intentionally stealing money from a client. It was basically a case of poor record keeping from an attorney who was did quite a bit of work on the case. And I forget the exact facts, but it was something like it was a bankruptcy case where the client came to him and wanted to file bankruptcy. And it was one of these rush things because there's this garnishment pending, and the utilities are going to come and disconnect my utilities. So we need to file the thing Monday. We need to file this bankruptcy case Monday. So the poor attorney, he gets he collects some money in advance, like $1,000 or something. And somewhere there wasn't a real good contract about what exactly it was, but the client anyway was under the understanding that he was paying $700 in attorney's fees plus $300 in filing fees. So the poor attorney worked all weekend was getting ready to file this thing on Monday morning. And then, Sunday night or whatever, the client calls up and says, well, you know what, I was able to figure something out. We don't have to file this after all. So the attorney, the attorney did all this work. He was entitled to compensation. So he kept the money. But then a couple years later, somebody brought it to his attention that, this $300, that was actually the filing fee, and you never filed the filing fee, so I should have gotten my money back. So he wound up getting suspended for 18 months over this $300, the $300 filing fee. So the moral of that story is, you know, when it comes to that kind of thing, you do have to, unfortunately, do meticulous record keeping. You do have to document things because, you know, I don't think this attorney did a whole lot wrong. I mean, it sounds bad. Sounds like he was stealing money from his clients, which, you know, is not a good thing to do, and we all agree on that. But basically, he was being sloppy. So the moral of the story is that you have to be careful. You have to be careful when you're working outdoors, that sometimes your workstation will fall down, and it's not planted on solid ground here. So just let me pause 1 second here while I get set up. Okay, I borrowed a music stand from my daughter, and they're to act as my podium, and it's really designed a little bit more for indoor use. So for those of you who are not here in person, we had a malfunction of our podium. So anyway, that's the Quinn case. Be careful. And at this point, I should give you a code number for those of you listening at home. Let's see, we'll call it D27. D as in Delta 27. D27 is our first code number. And the most recent case we have, I guess, is another attorney discipline case, the Trombley case from August 5th, I guess 2 weeks ago. Let's see, what did she, she did kind of convert some money, not from a client, but from her stepfather after her mother's death. Anyway, she was suspended 2 years ago. She admitted her guilt and so forth. And now she was petitioning for reinstatement. And kind of the question is, did she show adequate remorse to get reinstated? And the panel of the Office of Professional Responsibility said, no, you didn't show enough remorse. And they concluded that because they said, well, why did you embezzle this money? And she said, well, I embezzled this money because I really wanted to help the victim, because I thought I was doing something good for my my deceased mother and for my father-in-law, so I actually thought I was doing something good. The board kind of seized upon that and said, well, wait a minute, now you're trying to explain away your behavior. But the Supreme Court reversed, and they said, well, no, that's not what she was doing. She was not, that did not in any way indicate any kind of a lack of remorse, but instead, you asked, what was your motivation back at the time when you committed the crime? She was simply answering that question. Based upon all the other facts of the case, the court concluded that, yes, she should, she had shown remorse, and it was appropriate to reinstate her. I guess that was the only case decided in August. Turning back to July, State v. Jorgensen. The statute against it's not called extortion. It's called coercion. Minnesota statute 609.27. You're not supposed to coerce people. Because what happened in this case was the boyfriend broke up with his girlfriend, and at some point he was in contact with the girlfriend's father, and he said something along the lines of, "I want you to pay me some money, particularly $25,000. That's a fair amount for breaking up this relationship, but otherwise." I'm going to take this video that your daughter made where she talked about smoking marijuana, and I'm going to send that to the Department of Human Services and to the professional licensing board
that licenses your daughter. She had anonymity. She would, don't know what it was, but it was me telling one of you, give me money, otherwise I'm going to send the video of you talking about smoking marijuana to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility. The father did not send the money, but instead what he did was he contacted the police after some jurisdictional skirmishes. Apparently they charged him in the wrong county at first, but they charged him under this coercion statute. The defense was, well, wait a minute, this is the First Amendment. We're talking about speech here. I have every right in the world to make speech. I have this video. I have every right in the world to give that to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility or whatever licensing board it was. The state argued, well, wait a minute, there are exceptions to the First Amendment. One of them is fighting words. This is not really a fighting word, but a lot of the jurisprudence talks about true threats. If there's a true threat, that's an exception to the First Amendment, and you can be charged with coercion for making a true threat. The Supreme Court said no. The defendant is right. This is protected by the First Amendment because you have every right to engage in free speech, and this is not a true threat. A true threat, that's a term of art in First Amendment law. This did not rise to that. Basically, a true threat means a threat to do something unlawful, and here he was threatening to do something that is perfectly lawful. Now, I should point out that if you or I, as an attorney, engaged in this, that might be, classified as abuse of process or something like that. But just as a for purposes of the criminal law, you can't be charged with a threat for threatening to do something that's perfectly legal to do. Turning to our next case, the White Bear Recreation Association versus the DNR. This is arising in White Bear Lake, apparently White Bear Lake has a very, very small watershed. There are not many streams or rivers or anything that flow into White Bear Lake. White Bear Lake maintains its level just based upon rainfall, and it's tied into the underground aquifers. So the water level of White Bear Lake will go up and down depending on rainfall, and it goes up and down depending on how much water has been taken out of wells in the area. In 2013, it hit a historical low point because a lot of communities in the area get their water from wells. And every gallon of water that they take out of the well makes the lake level go down a little bit more. So the people who lived in the area of or the people who used to live on the shoreline, now the shoreline is a mile away or whatever, they didn't like that too well, and they sued the Department of Natural Resources. Why did they sue the DNR? Well, they because the DNR granted the permits to various cities that took water out of there. They said, well, wait a minute, you granted too many permits. And that violated the state environmental statute, which says that you can sue somebody for pollution, impairment, or destruction of a natural resource. Well, in this case, the lake was not polluted, but it was impaired or destroyed because the water let down. And there was any conduct. What conduct caused the water to go down? Well, a couple of things. One is somebody pumping water out of there. But number two, getting a permit, issuing a permit, saying, yes, you can take water and make the water level go down. So they sued the DNR because their conduct caused destruction of this natural resource. But the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that because conduct... it has to be some kind of concrete action that's being taken. So if I go in and actually pump the water out, That's one thing. But no, the act of issuing permit is not conduct that would expose you to liability under this environmental statute. They also raised a claim there is the public trust doctrine because navigable waterways in Minnesota, well, actually everywhere, I think, under the U.S. Constitution, navigable waterways are held in trust by the state. So the state has a duty to protect these things. So they said, well, you know, you're just breaching your common law duty under that public trust doctrine. You were supposed to, you know, state, you were supposed to hold this lake in trust, and you messed that up by taking too much water out of it. But the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to wade into that because, yes, that's not something that the courts can really adequately address and adequately decide. Because the Minnesota statutes on navigable waterways, you know, probably fill up a full volume. So it's the kind of thing where you have to, you can't just, you know, have the court poking its nose in this little lake over here and some other lake over here. That is a subject that they really have to give a great deal of deference to the legislature. Now, I guess if the legislature had never passed any statutes governing waterways, they kind of left it open that there might be grounds to resort to the courts, but no, that is pretty much vested in the legislature. So they threw that case out. A criminal case, State v. Gibson, was handed down on July 8th, it basically involved a traffic stop, because this guy was driving down Interstate 90, and he took the exit for Worthington. When you get to a stop sign, now we're out here, I can probably do a stop. Yeah, there's a stop sign over there. That stop sign over there. I have a visual aid to help me out today. But when you get to a stop sign, well, there's a statute that says you're supposed to stop. And where are you supposed to stop? You are supposed to stop at the sign. Or if there's a line painted there, you're supposed to stop at the line. This case involves what does the word at mean? Because this guy was driving along, he gets to a stop sign at the end of the ramp, and there's another statute that says before you enter a highway, you're supposed to look both ways and you're supposed to stop in a place where you can see the traffic that's coming both ways. So there was a line painted there. He kind of rolled through that line and then came to the world's greatest complete stop up right before entering the highway. And he looked carefully both ways, and he was the most careful driver in the world, and he turned onto the highway. And he got pulled over. Well, why did he get pulled over? Because he didn't stop at the stop sign. So the case was, what does the word at mean? If you ever need to know what the word at means, this is the case to do it. The Supreme Court, they pulled out the Oxford English Dictionary. And the OED says at means at a particular place or position. So here they said, well, when it said at the line, it means at the line, back at that line. And the driver found his dictionary from the dollar store or whatever had a little bit different definition where it said, well, it really means near. They didn't like that. He said, wait a minute. This other statute says, you know, there is a statute that says specifically where I'm supposed to stop. This other statute says you're supposed to stop so that you can see the oncoming traffic. And that's exactly what I did. And I couldn't see it back at exactly where the sign was. So that's the rule I was following. And the Supreme Court said, well, then maybe in some cases you have to stop twice. You have to stop at the sign. So this was a good traffic stop. And of course, after he got stopped for going through the stop sign, there was all kinds of indicia of forgery in his car. He got pulled over, and he had these check blanks, and he had all kinds of forgery materials. So he was actually a forgery case. But the Supreme Court said, that evidence that you found in the car, that's going to be excluded from the forgery case. So now you know what the word at means. Let's see, Palmer versus Walker Jamar Company. If you're involved in asbestos litigation, you'll want to take a look at that, because it tells when does the statute of limitations start to run. Pretty technical case. And here they missed the statute of limitations really just by a couple of weeks or something, because he was he filed one lawsuit in another state 6 years ago. So, you know, if you file a lawsuit in another state against another defendant for your asbestos exposure, well, then yeah, that kind of shows that you knew that you had the disease. So when he filed the case, you know, 6 years and 1 month later, it was past the statute of limitations. So anyway, that's the Palmer case. If you were involved in the medical assistance field, medical assistance planning, you'll want to take a look at the Schmaltz case from June 24. You know, because you're allowed to keep a certain amount of property if you go into a nursing home, and your spouse is allowed to keep a certain amount of property if you go into a nursing home. And this this delineates which is which. An effective assistance of counsel case is the Huisman case from June 10th. The defendant is a criminal sexual conduct. The defendant was 26 years old, and the victims were 12 and 13 years old. And the age of the victim was one of the elements of the offense. And also the age of the perpetrator was one of the elements of the offense, because he was charged with something that said the victim has to be under this age, and there has to be a difference of age of at least, I think it was like 3 years or something. So one of the things that the state has to prove, this 26-year-old and this 12-year-old victim are there, one of the elements that the state has to prove is that you know, the 26-year-old really is more than 3 years older than the victim. This case, it was a bench trial, there were actually written closing arguments. So the defense attorney submitted the closing arguments in writing, and there he basically conceded that, well, yeah, my guy was 26 years old. That's more than 3 years older than the 12-year-old victim. He basically conceded that element of the offense. The appeal was, well, wait a minute, I'm entitled to the effective assistance of counsel. I'm not going to, you know, being effectively assisted by my attorney when my attorney goes into court and admits in writing to one of the elements of the offense. The court said, no, don't, you know, that's, if you just walk into court and say, Your Honor, my client is guilty, well, that's one thing. Conceding one element that's really not in dispute, because obviously you could look at this 26-year-old and see that he was at least 3 years older than the victim. The Supreme Court said, although the guy won in the Court of Appeals, but the Supreme Court said no, that you got plenty of effective assistance of counsel. The Minneapolis, as you know, Minneapolis now has a sick time ordinance. Employers in the city of Minneapolis are required to give sick time to their employees, and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce et al. Disputed that. First of all, they said that the city ordinance was preempted by state law, because there's a chapter of the Minnesota statutes that addresses the topic that addresses the topic of overtime pay. So they said, well, that's preempted. It's a subject that the state legislature has already addressed in a comprehensive manner. And the Supreme Court said, well, yeah, they addressed it in a comprehensive manner, but only telling employers who do offer sick time how you have to do it. There was no state requirement saying that employers have to grant X days of sick time. So here, the city ordinance was outside the scope of the state law, so it was not preempted. The more serious challenge, though, that they offered was that this applied extraterritorially. So for example, if I own a messenger service and my office is in St. Paul or Bloomington or Eden Prairie, I have my headquarters right here outside the city of Minneapolis, and my messenger service delivers documents from Eden Prairie to Bloomington and from Bloomington to Roseville, and sometimes we deliver things to Minneapolis. Well, the city of Minneapolis said, well, wait a minute, that person is subject to the city ordinance because they work in the city of Minneapolis. The plaintiff said, no, that's an extraterritorial application. You don't have jurisdiction over anything outside of the city limits. But the Supreme Court said, in this case, that is, and they pointed out that, yeah, you can come up with some of these hypotheticals that are kind of bizarre, that, this person set foot in the city of Minneapolis, for 1 minute in the year or whatever. But they pointed out that there were situations that were a lot less bizarre than that. And one of them was the people who work as, I think they were talking about the custodians at U.S. Bank Stadium. Our billion-dollar stadium in Minneapolis. The custodians who work there are not employed by the U.S. Bank Stadium or the Sports Facilities Commission or anybody else. They're employed by, the Acme Cleaning Service. Which is not headquartered in Minneapolis. So these people get a paycheck from a company that is not in Minneapolis, but 100% of their work duties take place in the city. So the Supreme Court said that was okay. And kind of two interesting cases that they looked at from the past, from around 1900 or so. One of the cases was where the city of Duluth had an ordinance saying that you can't store explosives within the city or within a mile of the city limits. So the city of Duluth had an ordinance saying you can't store fireworks 1 mile away from Duluth. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court had said, well, no, that's extraterritorial application. You don't have any authority to regulate somebody's explosives a mile away, even though, yes, if they blow up, they might cause damage in the city, but that's not enough of a nexus. They distinguished that with a case from Minneapolis where the city of Minneapolis had regulations governing milk sold in the city. So if you sell milk in the city of Minneapolis, you have to make sure that your cows are not sick or whatever. And in that case, they argue, well, our cows are not in the city of Minneapolis, but you're selling the product there. So there, there's a line somewhere in there. I don't know exactly where it is, but the city of Duluth having regulating fireworks a mile away, that's not permissible. But the city of Minneapolis regulating cows 20 miles away, if that milk is brought in and sold. And they said this case kind of came down on the side of that Minneapolis milk case from 100 years ago. So that's a viable defense, but didn't work in that case. Let's see. Okay, now I didn't tell you there was going to be a quiz today, but how many of you honk your horn if you know what champerty is? Do you know what champerty is? Well, okay. You don't have to worry about it anymore because champerty is now legal in Minnesota under the Maslowski case. But what champerty is basically buying a cause of action from somebody. Specifically in this case, this person, Ms. Maslowski, had a personal injury case from a car accident or whatever. She was injured. So the case was pending. But she needed some money. She needed to pay her rent. She needed to pay her bills or whatever. So she went looking for money, and she found money in the Prospect Funding Partners company. And what they did was they would loan you money based upon your court case that's pending. And they advanced her $6,000. And the agreement was she would pay back the money, and the she would pay every 6 months, the amount that she owed went up 30%. So, you know, extremely high interest rate. But if the case got tossed out or whatever and she did not get any money from the case, she would not owe them anything. Well, the case did settle, and before signing this agreement, she gave it to her attorney, and her attorney was even required to sign something saying that, yeah, I talked to my client about this, we understand what's going on. So they agreed to that. And then the case settled, and she owed $25,000 on this $6,000. Well, then the same attorney went in and said, well, wait a minute, this that's against the Champerty law. Sure enough, there is a case from the Huber v. Johnson case from 1897. It says Champerty is illegal in Minnesota. The Supreme Court said, well, not anymore. That case is overruled. So Champerty is not a problem in Minnesota anymore. Now they did stress that if this contract were found to be unconscionable or something like that, the result would be very different. But they kind of pointed out the times have changed, because back when that Huber case was decided in 1897. For example, back then, contingent fees by attorneys were not legal. That's changed over the years, so it's now time. It's not an outright prohibition against Champerty, so it's okay if you don't know what Champerty means, because it's not a problem anymore. Now it is a problem for attorneys though, because one rule in the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct says that an attorney can never acquire a proprietary interest in a cause of action other than a contingent fee or an attorney's lien, if they're otherwise appropriate. So if this were not the Prospect Funding Partners, instead if it was the attorney saying, you know, in fact, kind of, you know, If the attorney had advanced $6,000 and said, you know, you're in, you know, dire straits here, I understand what's going on, the case is going to settle very soon, so I'll loan you the $6,000. After we settle, just pay me back the $6,000 with no interest. Well, that would be a violation of that rule. So it's not something attorneys can do. So here in this case, that outside firm. But you know, again, it is going to be scrutinized as to whether or not it's unconscionable. I had something kind of similar to this. I had a client, they had a structured settlement of, a case that, you know, they had been injured as, you know, when they were under 18, and they had this structured settlement where it wasn't a huge amount of money, but they were getting, you know, $1,000 a year or something. He sold that to a company that advances it. And one of the requirements from that company was you have to talk to an attorney, and the attorney has to say that they gave you advice. And I forget whether I finally wound up signing the thing or not, but, you know, I told the client, you know, if you can find any possible way of doing this other than that, and like I say, I forget if I signed off on him that I had warned him. Anyway, Champerty is now okay in Minnesota. The Olson versus Lesh case was decided in May, talks about legislative immunity. The defendant here, John Lesh, is a member of the Minnesota legislature, soon to not be. He got primaried. He lives actually in the district right next to mine. So he represents 66B. I live in 66A. He got taken down in the DFL primary. I think he was a former city attorney. I was kind of surprised to see that he had a successful challenge. But one of the things that happened while he was in office was he wrote a letter to St. Paul Mayor Carter shortly after his inauguration, marked personal and confidential. In that letter, he said, congratulations on your election. By the way, I used to be a city attorney in St. Paul, so I have some insight on it. And I see you're thinking of hiring this Olson to serve as city attorney. Well, I don't like her because she has a track record of integrity questions and management problems. He said, by the way, this letter is confidential. Don't tell anybody about this letter. Well, somehow she got wind of this letter, and she sued him for defamation because she said, well, wait a minute, I don't have a track record of integrity questions and management problems. That was libelous. So she sued for defamation. He said, well, wait a minute, this is governed by legislative immunity. Because the statute and the Constitution say that I have an absolute privilege either in my speech and debate on the House floor or when I'm carrying out legislative duties. But the Supreme Court said no, you don't have legislative immunity in this case, because even though this letter was written on letterhead, there was no business pending between the state and the city at that time. This was not a legislative matter. It was your personal opinion. You even said right in the letter that the letter was personal and confidential. No, you do not have immunity here. I guess at this point I should give another code number, E53 is our next code number. I'm spending more time talking today than I did last time. I have to pick up the pace a little bit, and I'll try to get maybe some more cases that I didn't cover last time. The Save Lake Calhoun versus Stroman, that was big in the news. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but we talked about White Bear Lake. Here we're talking about Bidea Makaska, and we have to learn how to say that so it rolls off our tongues fast, because that's the new name of a lake in South Minneapolis. It's now called Bidea Makaska, some of the plaintiffs here said, well, wait a minute, you can't change that because there's a statute saying that once a name is in effect for 40 years, it can't be changed. And the Supreme Court said, well, yeah, that's what the statute says if you're following that exact procedure under the statute. But on the other hand, the state does have kind of a plenary power to change names of geographic places. So if they're just acting under their general authority, they don't have to worry about the 40-year clause. Which, kind of seems to me that, maybe the Supreme Court was kind of rewriting the statute. But on the other hand, once I name something, here we are in Eden Prairie. Well, is this going to be called Eden Prairie 1,000 years from now? At some point there might be a need to change the name. I guess maybe that just applied to lakes. But, times change, maybe you have to change it. Leonard case says that... I hope they're not. I hear a siren there. I hope they're not coming to break up our gathering here. But we're under 25 people, so we're safe. Under the Leonard case, a hotel guest register, the police can't just go in and look through the guest register to see what's going on. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here. To get some that I didn't cover in the earlier program. From the Court of Appeals, a couple of cases. I guess we'll start with State versus Johnsgaard. Another forgery case. This guy was writing bad checks in Winona. He somehow got his hands on somebody else's checkbook. And he took a checkbook down to Midtown Foods in Winona, and he was writing checks and buying all kinds of stuff, and it was not his checkbook. And so the checks came back to the store saying the account was closed. Fortunately for the store, they timestamp every check when it comes in, so it was an easy matter to look at the surveillance cameras. And they showed the pictures around, and somebody said, "Hey, I know who that is. That's Stephen Paul Johnsgaard." One of his defenses was, he was this other guy that looked kind of like me. And in fact, he even came up with, "Yeah, I've heard this this guy named I think it was Jason. I heard there was this guy named Jason who looks just like me, and he's been pulled over by the local police and." So they actually came in and they brought in the mugshots of everybody named Jason or whatever the name was who had been pulled over by the local police in the last recent time. And he said, "Well, yeah, some of them look like me," but the jury didn't buy that. So he lost on that defense and he got sentenced to 24 months. But fortunately for him, and you know you're not supposed to write bad checks. Everybody knew that. And there's a statute, as you would expect, about writing bad checks. And there's a statute, Minnesota Statute 609.631, Subdivision 2, which makes it a crime to falsely make or alter a check so that it purports to have been made by another under an assumed or fictitious name. Oh, yeah, that's, writing bad checks. That's what you should be charged on. Comma, or falsely endorsing or altering a check so that it purports to have been endorsed by another. Well, for some reason, the prosecutor charged him under the second half of that statute. They charged, and they didn't just say Minstat so-and-so, subdivision so-and-so, and got the subdivision wrong, but they said, on so-and-so date, he did falsely endorse a check. Wait a minute, I didn't endorse anything. Because an endorsement, that means writing your name on the back of a check that was written by somebody else. You charged me under the wrong statute. I for the life of me, I don't know why they did that other than I guess somebody made a mistake in the prosecutor's office. The Minnesota Court of Appeals threw out the conviction. The district court let it go, but the Court of Appeals said, no, when this statute uses the word endorse, and they found a dictionary definition somewhere that said, well, endorse, yeah, he endorsed it by signing his name on the front. That's kind of like an endorsement. But they said, no, when a statute uses a term of art like that, like endorse, it's using the special meaning. In this case, from the Uniform Commercial Code and from Black's Law Dictionary. And what endorse means is you take a check that was written by somebody else and you sign your name on the back of it. And that's not what he did here. So we threw out his conviction. The another not too remarkable case, but just kind of good to see that the courts have a little bit of common sense, is the welfare of CF. Or the children of CF. This was a child protective case, and these three African American children were removed from their mother, and eventually her parental rights were taken away, and they were placed with an African American family with what the court described as a married heterosexual African American Baptist couple. And so they were placed there, and it sounded from the facts of the case, it sounded like the kids were doing reasonably well there. But for some reason, this couple got on the bad side of some social worker. The only thing I can see from the opinion was that this social worker just didn't like them for some reason and wanted to make their life difficult. Anyway, they were removed from this first family, and the social worker tried to take away their foster care license and so forth. That was ultimately rejected. The board that regulates that say was unfounded. The worst charge, from reading it, the worst charge they came up with was that this family, they didn't uh, they didn't properly launder the kids' clothes. You know, I mean, if you have little kids, I mean, you know, you're getting ready to go somewhere and you have this pile of dirty laundry, you know, and you tell them, well, you know, this one's clean enough, put this on, let's go. But they were removed from the house for that reason. And instead placed with a, quote, married family, a married female, same-sex Caucasian Lutheran couple. And then at that point, after the placement with this new couple, the parental rights of the mother were revoked, and both of these couples got in line saying we wanted to adopt these kids. And from the court, from the description, it sounds like this second couple was not doing nearly as good a job with the kids than the first one had. So the district court said, no, we're gonna give them back to this first family that had them, the African American couple. The second couple, the female same-sex Caucasian Lutherans appealed, saying, well, wait a minute, one of the district court based its ruling upon race. And sure enough, one of the things that the district court had said was, you know, these African American kids, they're doing a lot better with an African American family, especially the boy, having an African American father figure is important. And this other couple did not offer an African American background, and did not offer a male. So the district court thought that was important. They say, well, you can't do that. They pointed to some statutes saying you can't consider race or ethnic heritage. But those cases and those authorities really say you can't. Yes, you can. That is a proper consideration. They merely say that you can't delay an adoption on those grounds. So we have a placement. This family of a different race is willing to take, wants to adopt, let's wait until we can find somebody of the proper race. You can't do it in that case, but you can do it here. So the Minnesota Court of Appeals affirmed that. We're almost out of time here. Let's see if we can. Just hit a couple of out-of-state cases here. Nebraska dog bite. If you ever have a case against a city or a state or any government agency, one of the issues that's always going to come up is discretionary immunity. Who here is an expert on discretionary immunity? I didn't see any hands. That means you're honest, because I don't think there is anybody who is an expert on discretionary immunity, because it's more or less on a case-by-case basis. But these people were bit by a dog after school at the school playground, and there was a rule at the school for no dogs on the playground. So they were suing the school district, saying, well, you should have enforced this rule about no dogs on the playground. But the school said, well, but we can't enforce that 24 hours a day, so we've made the discretionary decision to only enforce that during school hours. And the Nebraska Supreme Court in that case said that's a proper exercise of discretionary immunity, because you're basically allocating government resources. Another animal case from the state of Iowa, kind of an interesting one, is Cohen versus Clark. Anybody with a disability, you have to reasonably accommodate their disability. Well, the plaintiff in this case was a tenant in an apartment building, and she was allergic to dogs and cats. So she moved into a building that said no dogs and cats allowed. It said so in the lease. That not only was she not allowed to have a dog, but the lease said, there won't be dogs anywhere in the building. Then a couple months later, somebody else moved in, and he brought in a note from his psychologist. And his psychologist said, this my guy, he really needs an emotional support animal. So they called the Iowa Human Rights Commission and said, what should we do? We got this note from this tenant saying he needs an emotional support animal. And they said, well, you have to let him have one. And then I think they said, well, we have somebody who's allergic. Said, well, that's her problem. So they brought this in, and she knew that there was a dog in the building even before they told her. And they had to kind of finally, they came up with a compromise of you use this stairway on this side of the building, you use this stairway on the other side of the building, and stay in your own side of the building. But even that was not enough. Now, they owned other buildings, and they, you know, when the guy asked for this, they even asked the Iowa Human Rights Commission, well, can we ask him to move to another building because we have this person who's allergic? They said, well, no, you can't do that. You can't force somebody to move just because they have a disability. So anyway, was this plaintiff greedy? No, she was not. What did she do? She went to a small claims court and sued for 1 month's rent because she basically couldn't live in her apartment anymore. And she had, you know, reams of medical records supporting her case. And I don't know what the small claims judge was thinking, but they threw out the case, and so did the district court. But she went to the Iowa Supreme Court. And basically, you know, well, yeah, this guy's entitled to a reasonable accommodation, but what about me? I'm entitled to a reasonable accommodation too. And the Iowa Supreme Court said, yeah, both of you are entitled to a reasonable accommodation. And how do we reconcile this? Well, basically, first in time, first in right was how it came down. So they were the first. She was there first, so she had to prevail. One of the defenses of the landlord was, well, wait a minute. What about me relying on the advice of the Human Rights Commission? And they said, well, you probably should have asked some more questions. So it's an unfortunate situation that you were in. I better give one more code number. How about F is in Fox 64? F64 is our third code number. Kind of an interesting case we really don't have time to look at. Lindgren, this was the Iowa Court of Appeals, just decided about a week or so ago. It was somebody slipped and fell in the hotel pool. Well, the hotel pool was licensed by the county, and there was an inspector that came around and looked at the pool every now and then. They subpoenaed him to testify at the trial over this accident that happened in the pool. So the city inspector, on his own motion, without telling anybody, before he came to testify, he went to the hotel and he took another look at the thing he had inspected a couple of years ago. And he even talked about it at the trial. And the Iowa Court of Appeals said, well, that was still relevant because there was really no indication that things had changed very much. And well, with that, I see we are at our time limit. So if any of you in the audience here, you can phone in your questions to 651-285-5474. Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you, both of you. If you do have any questions or whatever, I appreciate it. I see you took a couple of pictures. If you could email those to me when you get a chance, I'd appreciate that. Just so I have some record of this historic occasion here, the first ever drive-in CLE in Minnesota. The one place where I suspect I might wind up doing some of these is Minnesota, along with most other states, have allowed attorneys, at least the ones who report this year, to do all their hours on demand. So there's not a lot of demand for live programs. The one exception to that, though, is Wisconsin, where they are required to have their three ethics hours with a live program. So normally, about this time of year, August, I would be doing a lot of conference call programs for Minnesota attorneys. This year, all I have is Wisconsin attorneys getting that requirement, because they can do that with conference calls. But I'll probably wind up trying one of these in Wisconsin for the Wisconsin ethics. So thank you for being my guinea pigs today. I appreciate it. Okay, all right. Okay. Yeah, maybe, yeah, yeah. Well, that, you know, that would kind of prove your bona fides as an ethical attorney if you sit through an outdoor ethics session. So. Yeah, yeah. And thanks for not throwing fruits and vegetables. It actually, it does, yeah. Because, yeah, in the... Exactly, yeah. Yeah, because, yeah, the deadline is July or June 30th. But, yeah, if once you have it done, the new period starts July 1st. So the people who are doing it for the old session now, they're actually catching up. But, yeah, so you're right on track. You have 1 hour for 3 years from now. All right. All right, thank you.